When you grow up, you tend to get told that the world is the way it is. Your life is just to live your life inside the world, try not to bash into the walls too much, try to have a nice family life, have fun, save a little money. That's a very limited life. Life can be much broader once you discover one simple fact, and that is everything around you that you call life was made up by people that were no smarter than you. And you can change it. You can influence it. You can build your own things that other people can use. And the minute that you understand that you can poke life and actually something will, you know, if you push in, something will pop out the other side, you can change it. You can mold it. That's maybe the most important thing, is to shake off this erroneous notion that life is there and you're just going to live in it, versus embrace it, change it, improve it, make your mark upon it. I think that's very important. And however you learn that, once you learn it, you'll want to change life and make it better, because it's kind of messed up in a lot of ways. Once you learn that, you'll never be the same again. It's very interesting. I was worth about over $1 million when I was 23, and over $10 million when I was 24, and over $100 million when I was 25. And it wasn't that important because I never did it for the money. I think money is a wonderful thing because it enables you to do things. It enables you to invest in ideas that don't have a short-term payback and things like that. But especially at that point in my life, it was not the most important thing. The most important thing was the company, the people, the products we were making, what we were going to enable people to do with these products. So I didn't think about it a great deal. You know, I never sold any stock, and just really believed that the company would do very well over the long term. Now, I've actually always found something to be very true, which is most people don't get those experiences because they'd never ask. I've never found anybody that didn't want to help me if I asked them for help. I always call them up. I called up Bill Hewlett when I was 12 years old, and he lived in Palo Alto. His number was still in the phone book, and he answered the phone himself. Yes? He said, "Hi, I'm Steve Jobs. I'm 12 years old. I'm a student in high school, and I want to build a frequency counter. And I was wondering if you had any spare parts I could have." And he laughed, and he gave me the spare parts to build this frequency counter, and he gave me a job that summer in Hewlett-Packard, working on the assembly line, putting nuts and bolts together on frequency counters. He got me a job in the place that built them. And I was in heaven. And I've never found anyone who said no or hung up the phone when I called. I just asked. And when people ask me, I try to be as responsive, you know, to pay that debt of gratitude back. Most people never pick up the phone and call. Most people never ask. And that's what separates sometimes the people that do things from the people that just dream about them. You got to act. And you've got to be willing to fail. You've got to be willing to crash and burn, you know, with people on the phone, with starting a company, with whatever. If you're afraid of failing, you won't get very far.
A lot of people come to me and they say, "Well, I want to be an entrepreneur." And I go, "Oh, that's great. What's your idea?" And they go, "Well, I don't have one yet." And I say, "Well, I think you should go get a job as a busboy or something until you find something you're really passionate about, because it's a lot of work." And I'm convinced that about half of what separates the successful entrepreneurs from the non-successful ones is pure perseverance. It is so hard. You pour so much of your life into this thing. There are such rough moments in time that most people give up. I don't blame them. I mean, it's really tough, and it consumes your life. I mean, if you've got a family and you're in the early days of a company, I can't imagine how one could do it. I'm sure it's been done, but it's rough. I mean, because it's pretty much an 18-hour-a-day job, 7 days a week for a while. So unless you have a lot of passion about this, you're going to not survive. You're going to give it up. So you got to have an idea, or a problem, or a wrong that you want to right, that you're passionate about. Otherwise, you're not going to have the perseverance to stick it through. And I think that's half the battle right there.
My entire life's been spent only in one industry, which is this one. But I've been in it now for about 15 years, and I've seen a lot of people make a lot of things. I've seen a lot of people fail a lot of things. And my point of view on this, or my observation, is that the doers are the major thinkers. The people that really create the things that change this industry are both the thinker-doer in one person. And if we really go back and we examine, did Leonardo have a guy off to the side that was thinking 5 years out in the future what he would paint or the technology he would use to paint it? Of course not. Leonardo was the artist, but he also mixed all his own paints. He also was a fairly good chemist, knew about pigments, knew about human anatomy, and combining all of those skills together, the art and the science, the thinking and the doing, was what resulted in the exceptional result. And there is no difference in our industry. The people that have really made the contributions have been the thinkers and the doers. A lot of people, of course, it's very easy to take credit for the thinking. The doing is more concrete, but it's very easy for somebody to say, oh, I thought of this 3 years ago. But usually when you dig a little deeper, you find that the people that really did it were also the people that really worked through the hard intellectual problems as well.
What do you imagine the next 10 years of your life is going to be about?
This is probably a bad example, but I'm going to use it. When this whole thing with Gizmodo happened, I got a lot of advice from people that said, you've got to just let it slide. You shouldn't go after a journalist because they bought stolen property and they tried to extort you. You should let it slide. Apple's a big company now. You don't want the PR. You should let it slide. And I thought deeply about this, and I ended up concluding that the worst thing that could possibly happen as we get big and we get a little more influence in the world is if we change our core values and start letting it slide. I can't do that. I'd rather quit. You know, you go back 5 years ago, what would we have done if something like this happened? You go back 10 years ago, we had the same values now as we had then. Maybe a little more experience, certainly more beat up, but the core values are the same. And we come into work wanting to do the same thing today as we did 5 or 10 years ago, which is build the best products for people. You know, there's nothing that makes my day more than getting an email from some random person in the universe who just bought an iPad over in the UK and tells me the story about how it's the coolest product they've ever brought home, you know, in their lives. That's what keeps me going. And it's what kept me going 5 years ago. It's what kept me going 10 years ago when the doors were almost closed. And it's what will keep me going 5 years from now, whatever happens. Apple as a company doesn't have the most resources of everybody in the world. And the way we've succeeded is by choosing what horses to ride really carefully, technically. We try to look for these technical vectors that have a future and that are headed up. And, you know, different pieces of technology kind of go in cycles. They have their springs and summers and autumns, and then they, you know, go to the graveyard of technology. So we try to pick things that are in their springs. And if you choose wisely, you can save yourself an enormous amount of work versus trying to do everything. And you can really put energy into making those new emerging technologies be great on your platform rather than just okay because you're spreading yourself too thin. So we have a history of doing that. As an example, we went from the 5-inch floppy disk to the 3.5-inch floppy disk with the Mac. And there were some good reasons we did that. We got rid of the floppy disk altogether in 1998 with the first iMac. We also got rid of these things called serial and parallel ports, and we were the first to adopt USB, even though Intel had invented it. You first saw it en masse on iMacs. And so we have got rid of things. We were one of the first to get rid of optical drives with the MacBook Air. And I think things are moving in that direction as well. And sometimes when we get rid of things like the floppy disk drive on the original iMac, people call us crazy. But sometimes you just have to pick the things that look like they're going to be the right horses to ride going forward.